Chapter 20. There is nothing in Italy more beautiful to me than the coast road between Genoa and Spezia. On one side, sometimes far below, sometimes nearly on a level with the road, and often skirted by broken rocks of many shapes, there is the free blue sea, with here and there a picturesque felucca gliding slowly on. On the other side are lofty hills, ravines besprinkled with white cottages, patches of dark olive woods, country churches with their light open towers, and country houses gaily painted. On every bank and knoll by the wayside, the wild cactus and aloe flourish in exuberant profusion, and the gardens of the bright villages along the road are seen, all blushing in the summertime with clusters of the belladonna, and are fragrant in the autumn and winter with golden oranges and lemons. Some of the villages are inhabited, almost exclusively, by fishermen, and it is pleasant to see their great boats hauled up on the beach, making little patches of shade, where they lie asleep, or where the women and children sit romping and looking out to sea, while they mend their nets upon the shore. There is one town, Camaglia, with its little harbor on the sea, hundreds of feet below the road, where families of mariners live, who, time out of mind, have owned coasting vessels in that place, and have traded to Spain and elsewhere. Seen from the road above, it is like a tiny model on the margin of the dimpled water, shining in the sun. Descended into, by the winding mule tracks, it is a perfect miniature of a primitive seafaring town, the saltest, roughest, most piratical little place that ever was seen. Great rusty iron rings and mooring chains, capstans, and fragments of old masts and spars choke up the way. Hardy rough weather boats and seamen's clothing flutter in the little harbor or are drawn out on the sunny stones to dry. On the parapet of the rude pier, a few amphibious-looking fellows lie asleep, with their legs dangling over the wall, as though earth or water were all one to them, and if they slipped in, they would float away, dozing comfortably among the fishes. The church is bright with trophies of the sea, and votive offerings, in commemoration of escape from storm and shipwreck. The dwellings not immediately abutting on the harbor are approached by blind low archways, and by crooked steps, as if in darkness and in difficulty of access they should be like holds of ships, or inconvenient cabins underwater, and everywhere there is a smell of fish, and seaweed, and old rope. The coast road whence Camaglia is descried so far below is famous, in the warm season, especially in some parts near Genoa, for fireflies. Walking there on a dark night, I have seen it made one sparkling firmament by these beautiful insects, so that the distant stars were pale against the flash and glitter that spangled every olive wood and hillside, and pervaded the whole air. It was not in such a season, however, that we traversed this road on our way to Rome. The middle of January was only just past, and it was very gloomy and dark weather, very wet besides. In crossing the fine pass of Braco, we encountered such a storm of mist and rain, that we traveled in a cloud the whole way. There might have been no Mediterranean in the world, for anything that we saw of it there, except when a sudden gust of wind, clearing the mist before it, for a moment, showed the agitated sea at a great depth below, lashing the distant rocks, and spouting up its foam furiously. The rain was incessant. Every brook and torrent was greatly swollen, and such a deafening leaping, and roaring, and thundering of water, I never heard the like of in my life. Hence, when we came to Spezia, we found that the Magra, an unbridged river on the high road to Pisa, was too high to be safely crossed in the ferry boat, and were fain to wait until the afternoon of next day, when it had, in some degree, subsided. Spezia, however, is a good place to tarry at, by reason, firstly, of its beautiful bay, secondly, of its ghostly inn, thirdly, of the headdress of the women, who wear, on one side of their head, a small doll's straw hat, stuck onto the hair, which is certainly the oddest and most roguish headgear that ever was invented. The Magra safely crossed in the ferry boat. The passage is not by any means agreeable. When the current is swollen and strong, we arrived at Carrara within a few hours. In good time next morning, we got some ponies and went out to see the marble quarries. They are four or five great glens, running up into a range of lofty hills, until they can run no longer, and are stopped by being abruptly strangled by nature. The quarries, or caves, apostrophe as they call them there, are so many openings, high up in the hills, on either side of these passes, where they blast and excavate for marble, which may turn out good or bad. May make a man's fortune very quickly, or ruin him by the great expense of working what is worth nothing. Some of these caves were opened by the ancient Romans, and remain as they left them to this hour. Many others are being worked at this moment, others are to be begun tomorrow, next week, next month, others are unbought, unthought of, and marble enough for more ages than have passed since the place was resorted to, lies hidden everywhere, patiently awaiting its time of discovery. As you toil and clamber up one of these steep gorges, having left your pony soddening his girths in water, a mile or two lower down, you hear, every now and then, echoing among the hills, in a low tone, more silent than the previous silence, a melancholy warning bugle, a signal to the miners to withdraw. Then, there is a thundering, and echoing from hill to hill, and perhaps a splashing up of great fragments of rock into the air, and on you toil again until some other bugle sounds, in a new direction, and you stop directly, lest you should come within the range of the new explosion. There were numbers of men, working high up in these hills on the sides clearing away, and sending down the broken masses of stone and earth, to make way for the blocks of marble that had been discovered. As these came rolling down from unseen hands into the narrow valley, I could not help thinking of the deep glen, just the same sort of glen, where the rock left Sindbad the sailor, and where the merchants from the heights above flung down great pieces of meat for the diamonds to stick to. There were no eagles here, to darken the sun in their swoop, and pounce upon them, but it was as wild and fierce as if there had been hundreds. But the road down which the marble comes, however immense the blocks, the genius of the country, and the spirit of its institutions, pave that road. Repair it, watch it, keep it going. Conceive a channel of water running over a rocky bed, beset with great heaps of stone of all shapes and sizes, winding down the middle of this valley, and that being the road, because it was the road 500 years ago. Imagine the clumsy carts of 500 years ago, being used to this hour, and drawn, as they used to be, 500 years ago, by oxen, whose ancestors were worn to death 500 years ago, as their unhappy descendants are now, in 12 months, by the suffering and agony of this cruel work. 2 pair, 4 pair, 10 pair, 20 pair, to 1 block according to its size. Down it must come, this way. And there struggling from stone to stone, with their enormous loads behind them, they die frequently upon the spot, and not they alone. For their passionate drivers, sometimes tumbling down in their energy, are crushed to death beneath the wheels. But it was good 500 years ago, and it must be good now. And a railroad down one of these steeps, the easiest thing in the world, would be flat blasphemy. When we stood aside, to see one of these cars drawn by only a pair of oxen, for it had but one small block of marble on it, coming down, I hailed, in my heart, the man who sat upon the heavy yoke, to keep it on the neck of the poor beasts, and who faced backwards. Not before him as the very devil of true despotism. He had a great rod in his hand, with an iron point, and when they could plow, and force their way through the loose bed of the torrent no longer, and came to a stop, he poked it into their bodies, beat it on their heads, screwed it round and round in their nostrils, got them on a yard or two, in the madness of intense pain, repeated all these persuasions, with increased intensity of purpose, when they stopped again, Gautaman, once more, forced and goaded them to an abrupter point of the descent, and when they're writhing and smarting, and the weight behind them, bore them plunging down the precipice in a cloud of scattered water, whirled his rod above his head, and gave a great whoop and hallo, as if he had achieved something, and had no idea that they might shake him off, and blindly mash his brains upon the road, in the noontide of his triumph. Standing in one of the many studia of Carrara that afternoon, for it is a great workshop, full of beautifully finished copies in marble, of almost every figure, group, and bust, we know it seemed, at first, so strange to me, that those exquisite shapes, replete with grace, and thought, and delicate repose, should grow out of all this toil, and sweat, and torture. But I soon found a parallel to it, and an explanation of it, in every virtue that springs up in miserable ground, and every good thing that has its birth in sorrow and distress. And, looking out of the sculptor's great window, upon the marble mountains, all red and glowing in the decline of day, but stern and solemn to the last, I thought, my God, how many quarries of human hearts and souls, capable of far more beautiful results, are left shut up and moldering away, while pleasure travelers through life avert their faces as they pass, and shudder at the gloom and ruggedness that conceal them. The then reigning Duke of Medina, to whom this territory in part belonged, claimed the proud distinction of being the only sovereign in Europe who had not recognized Louis Philippe as King of the French. He was not a wag, but quite in earnest. He was also much opposed to railroads, and if certain lines in contemplation by other potentates, on either side of him, had been executed, would have probably enjoyed the satisfaction of having an omnibus plying to and fro across his not very vast dominions, to forward travelers from one terminus to another. Carrara, shut in by great hills, is very picturesque and bold. Few tourists stay there, and the people are nearly all connected, in one way or other, with the working of marble. There are also villages among the caves, where the workmen live. It contains a beautiful little theater, newly built, and it is an interesting custom there, to form the chorus of laborers in the marble quarries, who are self-taught, and sing by ear. I heard them in a comic opera, and in an act of Norma, apostrophe, and they acquitted themselves very well, unlike the common people of Italy generally, who, with some exceptions among the Neapolitans, sing vilely out of tune, and have very disagreeable singing voices. From the summit of a lofty hill beyond Carrara, the first view of the fertile plain in which the town of Pisa lies with Leghorn, a purple spot in the flat distance, is enchanting. Nor is it only distance that lends enchantment to the view, for the fruitful country, and rich woods of olive trees through which the road subsequently passes, render it delightful. The moon was shining when we approached Pisa, and for a long time we could see, behind the wall, the leaning tower, all awry in the uncertain light, the shadowy original of the old pictures in schoolbooks, setting forth the wonders of the world. Apostrophe, like most things connected in their first associations with schoolbooks and school times, it was too small. I felt it keenly. It was nothing like so high above the wall as I had hoped. It was another of the many deceptions practiced by Mr. Harris, bookseller, at the corner of St. Paul's Churchyard, London. His tower was a fiction, but this was a reality, and, by comparison, a short reality. Still, it looked very well, and very strange, and was quite as much out of the perpendicular as Harris had represented it to be. The quiet air of Pisa too, the big guard house at the gate, with only two little soldiers in it, the streets with scarcely any show of people in them, and the Arno, flowing quaintly through the center of the town, were excellent. So, I bore no malice in my heart against Mr. Harris, remembering his good intentions, but forgave him before dinner, and went out, full of confidence, to see the tower next morning. I might have known better, but, somehow, I had expected to see it, casting its long shadow on a public street, where people came and went all day. It was a surprise to me to find it in a grave retired place, apart from the general resort, and carpeted with smooth green turf. But, the group of buildings, clustered on and about this verdant carpet, comprising the tower, the baptistery, the cathedral, and the church of the Campo Santo, is perhaps the most remarkable and beautiful in the whole world, and from being clustered there, together, away from the ordinary transactions and details of the town, they have a singularly venerable and impressive character. It is the architectural essence of a rich old city, with all its common life and common habitations pressed out and filtered away. Simon compares the tower to the usual pictorial representations in children's books of the Tower of Babel. It is a happy simile, and conveys a better idea of the building than chapters of labored description. Nothing can exceed the grace and lightness of the structure. Nothing can be more remarkable than its general appearance. In the course of the ascent to the top, which is by an easy staircase, the inclination is not very apparent, but, at the summit, it becomes so, and gives one the sensation of being in a ship that is heeled over through the action of an ebb tide. The effect upon the low side, so to speak, looking over from the gallery and seeing the shaft recede to its base is very startling, and I saw a nervous traveler hold on to the tower involuntarily, after glancing down, as if he had some idea of propping it up. The view within, from the ground looking up, as through a slanted tube, is also very curious. It certainly inclines as much as the most sanguine tourist could desire. The natural impulse of 99 people out of 100, who were about to recline upon the grass below it, to rest and contemplate the adjacent buildings, would probably be not to take up their position under the leaning side. It is so very much aslant. The manifold beauties of the cathedral and baptistery need no recapitulation from me, though in this case, as in 100 others, I find it difficult to separate my own delight in recalling them from mere weariness in having them recalled. There is a picture of St. Agnes, by Andrea del Sarto, in the former, and there are a variety of rich columns in the latter that tempt me strongly. It is, I hope, no breach of my resolution not to be tempted into elaborate descriptions, to remember the Campo Santo, where grass-grown graves are dug in earth brought more than 600 years ago from the Holy Land, and where there are, surrounding them, such cloisters, with such playing lights and shadows falling through their delicate tracery on the stone pavement, as surely the dullest memory could never forget. On the walls of this solemn and lovely place are ancient frescoes, very much obliterated and decayed, but very curious. As usually happens in almost any collection of paintings, of any sort, in Italy, where there are many heads, there is, in one of them, a striking accidental likeness of Napoleon. At one time, I used to please my fancy with the speculation whether these old painters, at their work, had a foreboding knowledge of the man who would one day arise to wreak such destruction upon art, whose soldiers would make targets of great pictures, and stable their horses among triumphs of architecture. But the same Corsican face is so plentiful in some parts of Italy at this day, that a more commonplace solution of the coincidence is unavoidable. If Pisa be the seventh wonder of the world in right of its tower, it may claim to be, at least, the second or third in right of its beggars. They waylay the unhappy visitor at every turn, escort him to every door he enters at, and lie in wait for him, with strong reinforcements, at every door by which they know he must come out. The grating of the portal on its hinges is the signal for a general shout, and the moment he appears, he is hemmed in, and fallen on, by heaps of rags and personal distortions. The beggars seem to embody all the trade and enterprise of Pisa. Nothing else is stirring, but warm air. Going through the streets, the fronts of the sleepy houses look like backs. They are also still and quiet, and unlike houses with people in them, that the greater part of the city has the appearance of a city at daybreak, or during a general siesta of the population. Or it is yet more like those backgrounds of houses in common prints, or old engravings, where Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.